Hi, everyone. This is Kyler from Feeding Matters. Coming to you on August 22nd is the 2025 Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. This year, we're going deeper. We're hearing from more professionals. In fact, we're going to hear from all four domains of PFD, as well as the two domains from ARFID. And we're going to look across lifespans, starting with neonatology and going all the way to adulthood. Most importantly, we're highlighting the lived experience. So if you want to come together with other professionals who are engaged and dedicated to serving families and children who struggle to eat while hearing from those families directly, this is your opportunity. We'll see you on August 22nd.
Presented by Feeding Matters, with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Feeding Does Matter. I'm Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
Hi, I'm Haley Estrom, and I'm an associate professor at the School of Nursing in Wilmington, North Carolina.
So in our series to share the different experiences and perspectives of all of the speakers and disciplines coming to the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit, we have with us today Dr. Amy Talbot, whose session is called Formulation-Driven Treatment Planning for ARFID, a Collaborative Individualized Framework. And so I feel like Dr. Talbot's work is really in line with some of the things that even Haley and I have heard from our families about wanting that individualized care. So really excited to dive in deeper with you. Dr. Talbot, can you just give us a brief like background description, kind of how you even got into this work and became kind of a specialized discipline in this area?
Sure, no problem. So I'm a clinical psychologist, and early in my training, I was interested in eating disorders and eating behavior more generally. And so I worked predominantly in restrictive eating behaviors like anorexia nervosa. And I also had an interest in pediatric work and had done some work in neurodiversity and working with particularly autistic children. And I was working at an eating disorder service actually at the time, and we were doing a research trial. So everybody who was under 18 was assessed for the research trial and then determined whether they were eligible for the trial. It was a trial for Maudsley family-based treatment for anorexia nervosa. And around this time, we had this large number of referrals for young people who had eating-related concerns that weren't anorexia nervosa, and no one really knew what they were. And I was one of the only pediatric-trained clinicians at the service, and so they all got referred to me. Oh. So I had this caseload of young people with this presentation that we didn't really know very much about. We kind of knew it wasn't really an eating disorder in the traditional sense of what we had seen at the service. And therefore, the models of care that we would usually use weren't really relevant or appropriate for these young people. And I guess that's how I started becoming interested in pediatric feeding. Psychology wasn't, this was pre-ARFID being a diagnosis. So psychology wasn't very involved in the pediatric feeding space in Australia at that time. And I became really interested in learning from other disciplines, because I knew I needed to know something that would be helpful to all these families that I was working with. And I definitely made lots of mistakes in those early stages that I look back at now and go, oh, I wish I'd understood this about that then, or I wish I had I wish I could have approached that differently for that family. But I think it's also how I became so interested in interdisciplinary care in the feeding space, because I went and learnt under other disciplines and became really interested in what they were doing and the richness of what they could offer to my work as a psychologist as well.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much for sharing your background. It's always so interesting to see how people find themselves in this world. So in your view, what do you feel like multidisciplinary care looks like? You mentioned that that's a big interest of yours and you pull from other disciplines often. What do you think that looks like for the next 3 to 5 years in PFD and ARFID?
Yeah, so I'm really hopeful that there is actually a big push towards interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary care in ARFID and pediatric feeding. I'm hoping that over the next kind of 3 to 5 years, there'll be a stronger move towards neurodiversity affirming, collaborative and individually tailored care to the needs of each child and family. I think We're moving toward care that doesn't just look at feeding in isolation, but recognises that there's a broader picture that we need to understand about sensory processing differences and communication preferences and emotion regulation and a wide range of other things that make up what's happening for these individuals. And I think we're going to see more integration across the disciplines and specialties with better diagnostic clarity and shared clinical language in order to guide that personalised care. And most importantly, I'm really hoping that care becomes even more family-centred and adaptive. So less about fitting people into a specific model and more about building a model around the person so that care is more respectful and ultimately will lead to better outcomes.
Oh, I love that. I think that will really resonate with a lot of individuals within our community, both patients, families, as well as professionals as well. And that kind of pivots to my next question, which is, I know we're seeing some of those things come up, at least as a call from the lived experience, wanting to see that more in practice mm-hmm. and in clinical work and even research. But what do you feel like are emerging trends that you're excited about or maybe even concerned about?
Yeah, so we were talking about this as a team at our service, actually, in preparing for the podcast. So these are kind of the ideas summarized from our team, not just...
Love it.
I think that there is a lot of good work happening in the feeding space, partly because of the work that Feeding Matters is doing. And I think our team were especially encouraged that there does seem to be increasing awareness of feeding disorders. So the introduction of ARFID and... that being part of the DSM has meant that a lot more interest and research and money has been put into developing programs and understanding lived experience of individuals with these presentations. And I think there's been a big push to increase awareness across the board, not just with individuals, healthcare workers who might be providing services, but at identification level and, you know, everywhere. So we're really pleased to see that there is more awareness and more interest in mm-hmm. upskilling in ARFID. I was just making a calendar yesterday, actually, of all the events I have coming up. And I think we've been invited to present, I think, 4 or 5 workshops on ARFID in the next month alone. So there's definitely like increased yeah. interest in wanting to upskill, wanting to be able to support these families more effectively. I think there is that shift towards neurodiversity affirming care, less about trying to kind of fix feeding and more about respecting individual differences, which is going to move, I think, into a more compassionate and clinically sound space. And I do think there is more move towards the interdisciplinary collaborative care models as well. So the old kind of siloed ways of working are moving and giving way to more responsive or team-based approaches, which I think is a really good trend too. I think in terms of things we're concerned about, there is still in some spaces a reliance on kind of more outdated or overly behavioural models that we feel don't take into account the full complexity of feeding. And even some of the more newly developed models, I think one of the challenges in the research space is there's this idea in psychology, I'm sure that this might be the case in other disciplines as well, of like a gold standard model. So you're supposed to kind of do this particular treatment. And I think trying to find a gold standard model for feeding is impossible because of how multifaceted feeding concerns are. So I think we just need to be careful that the research that's invested and the time that's invested doesn't become a, well, everybody should be doing this treatment. And we don't lose sight of the individual differences or the needs that different people might have. And I think the other thing is there's still some challenges in our education pathways. So a lot of the clinicians that we do a lot of early career education, and lots of people graduate without having knowing anything about feeding. There's so many things kind of squish in to the training programs. And, you know, across the board, we take students from psychology, from speech pathology, from dietetics, like from a range of mm-hmm. disciplines. And this is the first exposure they get to feeding. And if they haven't worked in our service for their placement, they might not get any at all.
Very true.
It's so true. As we want treatment and we want best practices and we want families and patients to be part of those decisions and defining success and defining outcomes, it's also a matter of like which treatment for which child or adult works really well. And we need to continuously ask those questions.
I was wondering, like, what types of places are you being invited to give those presentations?
Yeah. It's an interesting mix across the board, actually. So there's a big push in Australia. The NEDC, our National Eating Disorder Collaboration, is doing a lot of work in this space. So we're doing some training as part of the Right Care, Right Place or Right Place, Right Care program in the Northern Territory. So I'm based in Sydney, and the Northern Territory is very under-resourced in general in terms of healthcare. So we're doing some training for them. We're doing some training in some of the PHNs locally to us, so the primary health networks where we are. So some of it is like NGO supported, some of it is government supported, some of it is like privately funded training. So quite a wide range.
So it's not just informational, it's actual training sessions. This is fantastic.
Yes. Yeah, so in line with that upskilling.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're going to move into our next section, which is more like the teaser content. So can you tell us a little bit about why you chose the topic of your Psych Summit presentation and why you're passionate about that topic?
Absolutely. So, you know, hopefully this has come through a little bit in what we said already. So. But I chose this topic because this is the approach that we use in our across the board, not just with feeding, but I think it's particularly important with feeding. And I think using a formulation-driven approach is really important to keep the person at the center. And it's really important when we're working with complexity or we don't have all the answers in terms of the research or what we know already. And so formulation-driven care really gives us a way to understand what might be happening for this individual, not just what's presenting on the surface. And when we look at ARFID and PFD, what's presenting on the surface is a particular cluster of behaviors, for example, and that's what gives someone a diagnosis of ARFID. These observable eating-related behaviors and these consequences of those behaviors. But what's actually driving that is so varied for the different individuals. Mm-hmm. And so we can't go, well, this is the behavior, we're going to address the behavior. We really need to have a more responsive, holistic, person-centered approach, not just that generic kind of treatment model. And so I think this approach invites collaboration across disciplines with the individual, with their family. And when we work this way, it's an opportunity to co-create care, which I think is more meaningful for everyone who's involved. So that's what we're going to be talking about.
And that formulation-driven approach, is that what you call your approach in particular, or is that... I haven't heard that term much before. Have you, Jacqueline?
Yeah, so I should maybe explain that. That's more, it's a discipline-specific term. So in psychology, we talk about formulation. Yes.
Okay. And importance of words.
Yes, absolutely. Language is very important. So, I mean, we do just call it that, but it's come from somewhere else. So it's not formulation is a more generic concept that's not specific to feeding. It's basically the way that we tell the story of the client and make sense of their experience. So it's like how do we make sense of and understand what is happening for this individual person rather than this is the model of feeding or this is the model of ARFID and how do we fit the person into that model? It's this more individualized storytelling approach. And then we use that story and the hypotheses that we generate in that story together to work out, well, what do we think is going to make a real difference for this person based on what we know from research or from prior experience or from models of care? How can we take what we know about that and use it to develop a treatment plan that's driven by the story of the individual?
Thank you. I'm learning.
And that's a great question, Haley.
I might be learning too.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the core question your session will answer and why is that critical?
So I guess off the back of just explaining what formulation is, I think the question that we're going to answer is how do we actually create individualized person-centered treatment plans in the face of a presentation that's quite complex and multifaceted? And I think, you know, as we've been talking about, this is an essential question because ARFID is a diagnosis that's based on observable behaviors or health outcomes rather than a diagnosis that is based on a shared underlying driver of that. And right. So individuals with ARFID have all these differences. They have sensory processing differences, anxiety, feeding traumas, oral motor skills differences. It might be occurring in the context of neurodivergence or relational feeding dynamics. And, you know, we don't have a clear shared way of understanding what's going on, then we can't provide integrated, effective, individualized care. And what we've seen is families being passed around from one service or one clinician to another, being told, oh, we think it's, you know, this kind of problem rather than that kind of problem. And so you should go see this discipline or you should go see that discipline. But no one will actually provide them with supportive care. And so we feel like this is a question that will help interdisciplinary teams, individual health practitioners, families, clients come together around a shared story of what is happening for the client that helps us to make decisions in the face of complexity that center the individual's goals and experience. So instead of creating kind of rigid plans like this is the model that we need to work from, it will help us to build something collaborative and flexible, but still give us a roadmap that we can work from and adapt with over time.
That would be helpful.
I think a lot of people will find value in that. I think it's a question that a lot of people struggle with. It's like, how do you build a framework for something that is so heterogeneous? And that's a question in clinical care and a question in research and a question all over the place. So I think it's a great discussion to have.
Absolutely. And, you know, we do a lot of this work with our early career practitioners in terms of there's some certainty or comfort in having a model, which is why kind of there can be that pull to have a manual or a gold standard treatment and be like, well, this is what I'm supposed to do. I think healthcare professionals genuinely want to be helpful.
An answer that'll solve the problem.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, I don't think we're ever going to be in a space where there's just one model that's suitable for ARFID and PFD. And so we need to be able to upskill and support people to have some kind of framework to work from that's going to enable them to be helpful, but be helpful in a way that is actually experienced as helpful by the families and individuals who are accessing care.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's one idea that you think you'll explore that might flip the way the audience is thinking about your topic?
Well, yeah, so we just kind of touched on this a little bit. I think one of the things that we really want to challenge in our presentation is the assumption that evidence-based care means following a specific protocol or manual. I think a lot of clinicians are looking for the right treatment model. But as we said, ARFID is this really heterogeneous presentation. And so a manualized one size fits all approach just probably isn't going to work. And so what I really want to be focused on is the idea that evidence-based care and person-centered care can coexist, that it's not about doing a manual and that's evidence-based care. It's actually about using this formulation that's built through our knowledge about how we understand the different elements of what drives feeding and that incorporates evidence and research into the way we think about what's happening for families and for individuals. And it's shaped by the individual and the family as well. So we're drawing on the research and the literature, we're drawing on our clinical experience, we're drawing on the family's lived experience and knowledge and centering that as equally valuable as the research that we hold. And we're pulling all of those things together and we're saying that that's what evidence-based care looks like. So we're holding that person-centered space and shifting maybe the definition of what evidence-based care looks like in ARFID and PFD.
Would there be a time eventually when this person-centered, formula-driven program could become the evidence base? Like, yes, there could be an evidence basis for this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. I think there has been, I have had some discussions actually with some of the people from the NEDC about how we might be able to take this approach and manualize it. So like how you know, the benefit of manuals is the dissemination.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Is that you can, if you publish something, it can be easily disseminated to other people. And we want as many people as possible to be able to use models that work. So there's this balance between individualized and facilitating individualized care and facilitating care that is effective, that can be disseminated as widely as possible. And so one of the things our team has been looking at is how do we manualize this more flexible formulation driven approach. And so that is something that we're working on at the moment.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it has to be an either or. Like, it could be a yes and situation where you could strive to have all the good things.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. That middle ground.
We would want the best for our children and their families. Okay, fantastic. Which disciplines, both expected and unexpected, do you think we'll find your topic especially relevant, and why?
Well, I mean, honestly, I think this topic is relevant for all disciplines. Anyone who works with individuals experiencing feeding challenges and their families. The whole point of the formulation-driven approach is that it brings together different lenses. So looking at sensory, developmental, relational, nutritional, psychological, and uses these different lenses to build a shared understanding of what's driving feeding difficulties. And so in our service and the way we approach feeding care, we don't believe that a single discipline holds the whole picture of understanding of feeding concerns. And so the challenge when we work in silos is that we risk missing key pieces of information or overwhelming families with competing advice. And so this session really highlights how we can collaborate effectively, how each professional or discipline has a vital role to play in helping make sense of what's going on and where to go next. And also, you know, how we can learn from each other. I mentioned at the beginning, my experience, it was going and learning from other disciplines to enhance the care that I could provide, understanding more about nutrition, understanding more about sensory processing, you know. Many of the people in our team are not OTs, but we've done sensory processing training, learning from OTs who are experienced in this area. So I think it's about how do we learn from each other and benefit from the shared wisdom of all the disciplines who contribute to feeding care. And therefore, I think it's for everyone.
Oh, I love that answer, Amy, just because it seems like you've approached your career and evolution in your own specialty with a very open mind, and really seeing curious to where is this going to take you and what discipline can help influence you to better your care for your families and really staying grounded in what your families need. And I also love what you said about not overwhelming the families with so much information, because I think that can happen so easily. I feel like we've heard that a lot, either on this podcast or from just families that we talked about Feeding Matters, of just like, I don't know who to talk to or trust because there's so much coming my way between different disciplines and what they want to manage the care. And so it really grounds it in how to be best supportive. And so I think that that's a great perspective.
And it's especially helpful when all the members of the multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary team are of a same mind and used to working together seamlessly, because then you don't receive, as a family member, conflicting information or ideas.
Absolutely.
That is so difficult to process.
And there's so many different disciplines often involved in working with these families. So. You know, because of the nature of what they're experiencing, they do need inputs from a range of different places.
Yes.
And so it's so easy to become burdened by the therapy and burnt out by the therapy processes instead of helped and supported by the therapy processes. One of the things that we often recommend at our service, we do an integrated interdisciplinary assessment. So you do one interview and you give all your background information. You don't go and see all these different people and repeat the same information again.
Fantastic.
And then You go and see the different disciplines to do the sections that they need to do, and we write one report with one set of recommendations, and we give that as feedback to the families. But one of the key recommendations that we often make if families have come to us with lots of different services is that they have a coordinator of services, someone who's going to oversee the treatment plans and care that's being provided by the different people in their team, and have meetings with them and make sure that there's like a shared goal and everybody is working towards the shared goal, even if they're in disparate places or they're not usually part of the same team. Because families just can't take that on top of all the extra things that they need to be doing to support the young people or their kids that have feeding concerns.
Do you have people available in the area that can provide that coordination service for people?
Yeah, so our service provides case coordination. So have an option where families can be referred to us just to do the assessment. So we can just do the assessment and then give them the report and they can take it back to their local practitioners, for example. Mm. We also have an option where we can get involved in case coordination only, but they can see all of their local practitioners. And so we just provide oversight of their care. And then we also have options where families can access direct treatment services from us as well, or they can mix and match. So they might access like our dietitian and their local speechy because they need face-to-face sessions for speech, and we might provide case coordination. So we've really tried to think about what are the services that our clients actually really need, and how do we make sure that they can access local services if they need to for face-to-face care, but they can still have the benefits of this integrated multidisciplinary approach. And so we see, even though we're located in Australia, we see clients from all over the world. As you're probably aware, not everywhere has great access to feeding services. So we see clients from Asia and from Europe and various different places for this reason.
Well, oh, that's lovely.
Really great way to honor being collaborative and supportive of the families. As we narrow in on our session today, I wanted to do a few questions for our closing. As you prepared for your session, were there any fun behind the scenes prep work that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I had to think about this and talk to the team. As you might have gathered from earlier, that although I'm presenting the work, it is teamwork. It's being presented, we're representing a range of disciplines, perspectives. And so, of course, I consulted other members of the team to include their perspectives in the presentation. And so we really love working together as a team. This might not come as a surprise, but we love food at our service. So we like to eat together. We like to try out new feeding strategies together over lunch or coffee. I recently brought my 5-year-old son in to try some new bread make painting activity. That was one of the things, the speech she wanted to try out with some clients. She's like, oh, can you bring your son in and we can see how it goes and whether he likes it and whether it seems like a good activity. So, you know, we participate in the activities and try them out. We do random food tasting at our service. So just within our team, someone will find a food and bring it in and be like, have you tried this? Like, this is what it's like. So we do lots of food-related activities, not specifically for this presentation, but just kind of generally as a service.
I'm wondering how that's going to be incorporated in your summit presentation.
I mean, these specific examples are probably not in the presentation, but it just gives you a sense of what our team is like. I feel like it's
the X factor to how teams work. Like all teams need their kind of like ecosystem and their ethos of how they work together. And it sounds like you all have found the ways that you can bond and be collaborative and build that trust together.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think, you know, the way we prepared for our presentation reflects kind of the theme of our presentation as well, that, you know, it's different disciplines and perspectives coming together, shaping care, mixing our expertise and ideas and then just like a little bit of joy thrown in there as well, in enjoying the time that we spend together and centering that around food.
Yeah. A little splash of joy. What other sessions besides your own are you looking forward to within the summit?
Well, I think you've put together a really fantastic program. So I'm actually looking forward to all of the sessions. But if I had to pick something in particular, I always love learning from people with lived experience. So I'm especially excited to watch the ones where people with are sharing their lived experience. I think it's a real privilege to learn from people directly. Their insights bring a depth and authenticity that you just can't get from other types of learning. And I'm really grateful for their courage and willingness to share their experience in order to benefit others and to benefit healthcare professionals. A lot of the learning that I did early in my career came from learning directly from families. And so I'm excited that that's an opportunity within the summit as well.
Yeah, thank you. Because that's, it's, I think that it's one of everybody's most like looking forward to sessions mixed within. And it's not a shocker that you are the practitioner that you are now because of where you started and how you still stay so person and family centered. And that's kind of the origins of this podcast too, was making sure that we are having that conversation. And one of the questions that we ask guests on the podcast are, what are the barriers to research being patient and family-centered? And do you have any solutions to that?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
I know it's a loaded question.
I think one of the barriers is that often the people conducting the research are not the people who are working with the families. So a huge barrier to involving families in the process of research is that researchers sometimes don't have that direct access to families, or they don't have pathways through which to facilitate the access that they might need to families. And then families might not be able to find out about the research opportunities that, that could be available. I think it's that separation of research and clinical work that most people are either researchers or they're clinicians. And so, you know, we don't see that real integration of research on the coalface, on the ground, with clinicians who are working directly with families, driving the kind of ideas about what it is that they're looking at in the research. We often see researchers driving the ideas based on what they've read or what's already been published, which is like way behind in some ways where we could be at if we just listen to the people who are doing the work or living the experience now. So I think there aren't a lot of avenues for researchers without having done the ethics and done all of the things already to learn directly from people with lived experience. And it makes it then hard for them to shape how they produce their research or what they do in research in that regard. And I think it's also, I think, to do with how the money is allocated. So the money is often not allocated for the qualitative research that would inform all of these sorts of things, right? So one option is to do qualitative research to learn from people with lived experience and then decide what to do in terms of quantitative, measurable treatment outcomes, et cetera. But the money is really in the measurable treatment outcomes. And so, you know, I think that there's some challenges with the way research is funded that also interferes with that process. I think it's getting better in Australia recently, not in a feeding related area, but in something different. We went in on a collaborative grant with a university, like a large research center.
Yeah.
And one of the requirements of the grant was that they had like genuine partners with lived experience, like on the ground, and that they had genuine partners of like on the coalface workers. So we were the on the coalface workers on the ground because they had to be able to demonstrate that the research had real world validity and that people would actually use it. So I think there is a shift gradually kind of in the way that funding is happening in the research space. I think the real thing that needs to happen is clinicians need to get more involved in research. People who are, you know, on the ground working with the families, they need to be involved in research. There needs to be allocated hours and time to do research in clinical roles and in clinical.
That's probably the biggest barrier is the time and the hours.
You know, I remember asking someone who was the developer of a reasonably well-known intervention in the feeding space, why is there so little research on this model, given that it's been around for so long? And one of the things that they said was, well, it's predominantly delivered by speeches and OTs, and speeches and OTs don't have any research allocation in their clinical roles. So there isn't anyone to do the research who's delivering the program.
Yeah, and both disciplines don't have a long history. They didn't get their PhDs until very recently. And so there wasn't even that incentive on the academic side either. And that's kind of another factor variable that we see in that as well. That's a very good point.
Yeah. So I think having that integrate, we're talking about a lot about integration today.
Yeah, like we're busting silos all over the place, Amy.
Disciplines, integration of, you know, families with healthcare workers. And then, you know, I think we need to be looking at that integration of research into clinical practice, whether that's through partnerships, whether that's through time allocation, whether that's through the way that funding is done, so that it's an expectation rather than something nice to have in the way that research is designed and developed.
That's so true. I think the members of our consortium, our patient and family research consortium, will really love that. They are a body of patients and who want to be involved in the research. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time today and for sharing about your session. We're very excited about it. The Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit is on August 22nd, and it's also available on demand. So we encourage you, listeners out there, to consider attending the summit just to bust silos and learn from each other and learn from lived experience. And Amy, it was just great to have you. So thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And we're looking
forward to it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
When supporting a loved one with feeding differences, it's easy to feel like you're alone. At Feeding Matters, our hope is for you to find the community, resources, and support that you need. Through our Power of Two parent-to-parent mentoring program, parents in need of support are matched with one of our volunteer family coaches who have lived experience with their own child and can offer emotional support, resources, and guidance to lessen the isolation that families often face with pediatric feeding disorder as well as avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. Families can request a one-time phone call or a 3-month or 6-month match by filling out the request form on our website. A family coach will make contact via text or email first to set up a phone or video call, typically within 2 to 3 days. For more information, please contact us at 623-242-5234 extension 1 or at feedingmatters.org. And please remember, you're not alone.